Welcome, everyone. So it's nice to see everyone, both here in person and also on the Zoom world. Special welcome to anyone who might be joining us for the first time tonight. My name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. So tonight we go into the fifth picture of this series of ox herding pictures. So if you're just coming, you know, for the first time, this is kind of what are we doing here? This insight practice, what's all this Zen pictures have to do with our practice or meditation practice? And really the ox herding pictures are a nice way to complement our own insight practice. It's a different way of looking at different lens, and it kind of highlights things that we may not see. And particularly in the Zen practice, and especially these pictures have a strong pointing toward why do we practice? Really, what's the ultimate aim for it? And also, it's a beautiful depiction of the evolution or unfolding of our practice, if you will. So this fifth picture, it's really, again, these ox herding pictures are overall, it's an expression of the spiritual journey, both in a very kind of mundane way, if you will, just how our meditative practices unfold, but also how the deeper spiritual practice can unfold. And so it's a point can work. We can work it on both superficial level and also a very deep level. And a search for our true nature. And in some ways, this fifth picture makes the most sense in terms of our meditative practice. We can really kind of see, oh yeah, this actually shows up in how I'm meditating, how my mind works and how my mind unfolds in the course of a meditation or a meditation retreat. You know, both the effort to meditate, how to work with the mind, dealing with the hindrances. And then when we start to have the meditation, just start to cook along where it's almost doing automatically. We don't have to have a lot of effort. This picture kind of encapsulates all of those aspects. And yet this picture also points toward the nature of duality, of separation. It's kind of embedded in a subtle way in this picture, which makes more sense as the other five pictures unfold. And really the division between in ourselves, division of how we see self and other, and how we divide parts of our own selves, our own minds, our own hearts. So this picture is pointing, it's coming from that perspective. But then we, over the next few months, we release that. And also the end of our will and our effort. So I want to explore both of these aspects, that latter part about duality at the end. But first, kind of looking into how these pictures show up in our meditation practice and how they show up in our daily lives. And our daily lives are such an essential part of how do we become really embodied practitioners. We don't just practice to have this kind of escape. It's really meant to transform how we show up in our lives, how we show up in our relationships, our work, our family, and in society. So let's talk about this picture and the verse. And first ponder the picture for a second. So I'm going to turn off my video so you can see the picture. And if you could highlight me there, Cheryl, spotlight me or pin me, I guess, whatever it is. Okay, I will do it. Oh, no, it's there. That's good. Okay. So if you just look at that image for a second, it's kind of nice to take in this traditional, you know, Chinese or Japanese art of watercolor and black and white. And it's, you know, it's a very vivid image. And there's this little boy holding this huge ox. You know, the boy's probably like a fifth the weight of the ox. No match for the ox, but yet the ox is just following along, very tame, very connected. The line is very slack. Remember last month, the line was really taut as this little boy is trying to wrestle with this huge, powerful, wild beast. And this picture really depicts the latter part of this verse. So it's kind of depending on where they choose to put the verse and the picture. This is a little bit later in the verse. Now let's look at the verse. We'll go through it step by step. Now, as I read in the at the end of the meditation, I'm going to have two versions of it. There's one that I prefer, actually, it's a little bit more poetic, but the one that's online that we found to be able to post it first. So the whip and rope are necessary, else it might stray off down. Some dusty road, being well-trained, it becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, it obeys its master. Right? So this taming of this wild animal. Another verse, the other version, translation, is the whip and tether cannot be put aside, or the ox may wander into mud-filled swamps. When patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle and can be unfettered. And then freely, it follows your way. So we can take these verses and divide it into three sections. I think it's a handy way to kind of get a handle on them. The training and discipline, the first section. The second was the becoming tame and gentle. And then finally, following direction willingly, following the lead of ourselves, really. The first section here, the training and discipline. So the whip and rope are necessary, else it might stray down some dusty road. Or the whip and tether cannot be put aside, or the ox may wander into mud-filled swamps. It's kind of fascinating that these two translations, one talks about the dusty road, the other one the mud-filled swamp. But they're both applicable. They just have different elements, the dry dust, the lack of water, and there's too much water getting caught in the mud. Those who have done Qigong, when I teach it on retreats, there's one move called stepping off samsara. And I like the image of like having, you know, mud up to your knees and you're trying to lift each leg out of that muck and pushing it down, stepping out of samsara. So this part of the verse really describes the work of meditation, the effort, the wise effort of meditation, and of learning to work with our busy minds. And to develop that steadiness of attention, that sustained attention, how do we start to yoke our attention so it stays where we want it to stay? You know, and sometimes it really does feel like that its mind's going all over the place and we're gently trying to bring it back. We've got a tether to it, we're trying to pull it back to the present moment. This also applies to our reactivity in life and how we meet our patterns of judgment, of complaining, of comparing, of inadequacy. You know, how do we meet the difficulties we have that society brings toward us? How do we navigate that? This is much of what we explored last year in the Daily Dharmas. You know, taking these really concrete, nitty-gritty things that we struggle with in our lives and bringing it the lens of Dharma into that. And so we can see there's almost a contrast between our sustained practice, whether it's a meditation period or a day long like we have coming up on Saturday, or on like a longer retreat or practicing for many days versus a daily life practice. How do we really bring it into our lives? So in some ways, it's easier to see this particular picture unfolding in a sustained practice period. But it's more important to see how it shows up in our daily life, because that's really where the expression of our practice comes out. If you look at these 10 pictures, it's not to the very last picture when the person comes back into the marketplace transformed. But we start to bring that, you know, we don't have to wait till we completely awaken to come back into our lives. We can come back in small ways, in easy ways, meeting life the best we can, moment by moment. So looking at this picture, you know, I was reflecting, okay, what does the ox really represent? It represents our true nature. But it's our true nature that also has this kind of element of wildness to it, of untamedness. We can almost see it as that true nature that's really covered up by the powers of delusion, of ignorance, of greed, hatred, and delusion. It has the quality of the hindrances, our tendency to struggle with life, our reactivity. Some people, one teacher called it the monkey mind, the mind that just keeps thinking and thinking. And this is really what we work with day in and day out as meditators. How do we work with the mind that just keeps thinking, that keeps comparing? How do we find some place of peace? You're right here in this first verse, trying to harness this, trying to tame this wild part of our minds. So the whip and tether are still needed. Now that's kind of an intense language this day and age, whip and tether, because we think of the violence of that. And part of it is the archaic nature of this verse and kind of made more sense perhaps when it was composed. Because so much in our modern society, we emphasize kindness, compassion as an antidote to our own self-hatred, our hatred that we've learned, you know, to apply to ourselves, that we've learned from society. And there's this way that we really need to clean that up, because otherwise we just apply it right to our meditation. I mean, how many of us in the room and in the Zoom room have ever been critical of yourself when you've been lost in thought? You know, it's like, yeah, it's like almost, if we're honest, I think almost all of us go through that stage. It's like, I'm getting lost in thought. How can I get my mind to quiet down? You know, if I was a better meditator, I wouldn't be lost in thought. You know, there's this harshness that we bring in, this self-judgment. We really take our normal view, the way we take ourselves to be, the way we construct our sense of self around this kernel of self-inadequacy, and we naturally apply it to our meditation, just like we apply it to everything else in our lives. So learning to free that up can be incredibly transformational. So that's why we really emphasize that. You know, so the phrase, you know, whip and tether, you know, take that with a grain of salt. And yet, it also points to the firmness that's needed. Because if we have no sense of structure, no sense of container, no sense of direction or discipline in our practice, we are kind of like that wild animal that it goes sometimes this way and sometimes that way. Like the last picture, we were trying to catch the ox. Sometimes we have a hold of it, and sometimes it's off, who knows where. It just disappears. Does that describe anyone's mind when they're practicing? You know, it describes mine at times. So learning how to kind of yoke that mind, to contain it, to have that sense of focus is so much of our practice. It's not the end result. And that's what this picture and this whole series as a whole points to, that sometimes we take that as being the final end point. Once I got this thing tamed, I'm done. That's all I have to do. And it's actually, this is just halfway through the pictures, just halfway through. And yet we have to learn how to have that taming. I was teaching a retreat with my friend and colleague, Carrie Peterson. I know some of you were on that retreat, Jean and other people here on the call. And it was an interesting retreat that for various reasons, there was about 15 people. This was their very first retreat. And a lot of them had used an app called Headspace and only practiced maybe 10 or 15 minutes a day. So you can imagine the courage to go from a 10 or 15 minute a day practice to practicing from 6:15 to 9:15. You know, for 5 days in a row. It's a lot of an act of courage. And yet there's this spirit that this picture really points toward, is that willingness to, okay, I'm going to really bring some energy, some discipline to my practice. And I really appreciate those yogis, because for whatever reason, yeah, Headspace or maybe that group of yogis, they were well prepared. They had the attitude was right. They had the right attitude for meeting their experience and practicing well. So we do need some effort, some, hopefully it's wise effort. We need a sense of discipline, a sense of grit, willingness to continue to practice, even when it may not be easy, even when it may be difficult. A daily practice is a great example of this. It's, you know, how do we practice even though we may not feel like practicing? We're tired, sleepy, agitated. I remember years ago, one of my first, you know, careers was being a wilderness ranger, which is kind of an odd career, being a seasonal ranger. But we had to go out in the woods in all kinds of weather, rain, snow, sun, bugs, no bugs, it just whatever was the conditions, snow, no, you know, snowy paths, we learn how to adapt to that, how to meet that, how to actually appreciate those different weather systems. But so often we're kind of, you know, as if you don't have to do that, if you're not paid to do it, you tend to, it's rainy, you don't go out. You know, we tend to be fair weather hikers, which is fair enough. But we don't want to be fair weather meditators. We want to be able to meet our minds no matter what the conditions are. Because life, it's like we're preparing ourselves for those conditions that hit us, that we're not expecting, that are shake us to our core. And having this daily practice provides this foundation for it. We're learning how to really tether our minds, how to work with our minds so it becomes focused where we really need it to be. Because life throws these things at us. This last month, I mean, just horrific of having the shooting, the 10 black shoppers being murdered, having the attempted murder of the Taiwanese churchgoers, to have the children murdered in the elementary school. I mean, this shakes us to the core, and all the other shootings that have happened. And like today, I found out that there was someone at my daughter's school was arrested for a credible threat. You know, as a parent, you know, that just shakes you to the core. And that's what I'm talking about, of having the momentum of a daily practice. That's where the storm comes in. How do you meet that? How do you not become lost in those swamps? How do you not get lost in the dust? How do you actually find that sense of tethering into the present moment? It's not easy. The mind, you know, the heart is filled with fear, filled with emotions and thoughts. And yet we can find, okay, here's this present moment. And then how do I meet that? How do I find the right way to act? How do I meet my teenage daughter? How do I meet whoever I might try to influence to make this be less of a dangerous world for our children, for our black brothers and sisters, for our Taiwanese friends, for everyone? How do we bring that sense of safety into the world? It starts with having that point of contact in the present moment. And that's why this picture is so important, to remind us of our discipline of practice, our cultivation of practice. Meditation is, that's the word we've used to translate, but a better translation is cultivation, bhavana, cultivation of that steadiness of mind, of heart, and be able to meet the moment. And the daily practice gives us this capacity to meet the moment when we're tired, when we're agitated, when we're filled with fear, anger, lust, whatever it might be. So this practice, this first picture really points to this cultivation of this steadiness of attention. In my early days of practice, I learned this technique of noting. Of basically, those who are not familiar, you're noting what the moment is showing. You might be breathing in, might be breathing out, something as simple as that. Or you might be noting different parts of the body to kind of give your mind something to do. But it connects your body, your mind, with what's actually present. So this one teacher said, you can actually note out loud. So I would be practicing, you know, by myself, you know, saying breathing in and breathing out loud, because he's called like the different gears in a car. Like all four-wheel drive is like when you're stuck in the mud, you want to get into four-wheel drive, you're going to note out loud. That brings a lot more energy, a lot more discipline to each breath. And then once you start to get out of the mud, you become more steady. The ox is a little bit more tame. Note silently. And when the ox starts to follow you, drop the noting altogether. And so bringing that perseverance, that grit to, okay, notice when your mind starts to drift, when you start to become lost down those muddy paths or those dusty roads, bringing some energy to it, but bringing it in a gentle way, in a kind way. This is where the second one comes in. Actually, before I go into the second one, I want to just circle back to, we're talking about the meditative practice, but our daily life practice, same thing applies. You know, so we all have those habits of mind. sometimes we start to see that, maybe all the time, see it with much more clarity when we start to practice. You start to see, oh, wow, I don't realize how judgmental I really am. I don't realize how much my mind is caught in comparing. Because you get to just sit still and watch what the mind's doing. And it just shows it. I mean, you can be sitting silently in a retreat for 5 days and not say another word to another person. And the comparing mind saying, wow, so-and-so is sitting really still. They're sitting much better than me, or that person's walking much better. And it's our mind just paints that out there. Okay, so our daily life is actually a profound way to bring our practice to bear, to bring the same quality of investigation and energy to actually see, okay, how can I meet life? How can I pick something like a pattern of comparing and notice it? Notice how often I do it. Notice what it feels like inside to do that. How has it changed my relationship to another person? All in the order of not judging yourself more, but understanding the pattern. It's like taking mindfulness and directing it toward this pattern, this reactive pattern. It's trying to learn to work with something, taking a precept and really taking it on, like not taking that which is not freely offered or stealing. It's a shorthand. You know, speaking what's true. Learning to work with feedback, using life itself as a feedback, those rubs, those pushbacks, and how to actually change that. Yeah, but how we do it is so important. So this first section of using the taming process, using the whip and tether are necessary. That's the discipline. But it's so important to have this second section as part of it. This is the attitude of kindness, of gentleness, of non-harm. Because without that, we can get very exhausted. We become overwhelmed, and actually a lot of tension arises. So this is becoming tame and gentle. So the two translations, being well trained, it becomes naturally gentle. Another translation, when patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle. Okay, I like that. When they're patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle. So from the meditative standpoint, this is really the development of concentration, samadhi, steadiness of mind, that firmness of mind, the mind that doesn't waver so much. It's like being able to take a flashlight, Rodney's favorite analogy, shine it on something and it's steady. It doesn't waver. Usually our minds are going this way and that way. We're all over the place. But to do this, the paradox is learning this sense of non-reactivity, of non-resistance to the moment. That way the practice starts to do itself. This picture is kind of a joke because we think of we're taming the ox or taming our minds, but really the ox, and in some ways, is taming us. It's really taming our own inner reactivity. The ox is kind of this external manifestation of it, this external metaphor of this separation. So how do we develop that steadiness, that concentration? So there is a gentleness, a kindness, and yet a firmness. How do we balance these two? You know, a classic analogy is if you're trying to train a puppy that, you know, to use the go to the bathroom in the right spot, you come back with gentleness. You come back with harshness, the dog starts to become afraid and conditioned to be afraid. Come back with love, with kindness, then the dog starts to learn that. Not adding that element of self-judgment. It's really, again, so embedded in the way we actually see and look at the life. And this is where it's interesting paradox that I work with all the time with students is that so often, when we're struggling with something, the basic attitude is that the thing we're struggling with is a problem. I'd be much better if that problem wasn't here, is kind of the attitude. So embedded in the attitude of the relationship, if you will, is I'm trying to pay attention in order to get rid of. I'm going to listen to you in order to get rid of you. I'm going to listen so you would shut up, that kind of a thing. The paradox is that the more we object to the moment's experience, the mind state, the body, the emotion, the more noise, the more struggle comes up from that. The more the struggle arises from that. It's like one of my favorite analogies is if we went out to a pond and we saw the ripples caused by us walking to the pond and we wanted the ripples to stop and we were using our hands to try to splash the ripples into quiet, how well does that work? We just make more and more ripples, more and more waves. But if we just, okay, I'm going to let the waves and the ripples calm down of their own accord, then stillness starts to rise. The exact same thing with whatever comes up in our mind. It's not talking, we're not talking about how we deal with life and how we have right action, how we have compassionate, wise, sometimes very forceful action. It's learning how to meet this moment, how to really meet this breath, this mind state. Another analogy I like to use is this almost bowing toward these patterns. Because so often we see a pattern, like let's say it's of judgment, and we say, okay, I see this pattern, I'm seeing it more and more clearly, I'm seeing how much it causes trouble, and we don't realize that we're judging the pattern, that you know we're judging the judgment. And we can learn to actually interrupt that by almost, I like to say, even physically bowing toward it. The next time it arises, you bow toward it and say, thank you for how you've served me. So suddenly I'm no longer in opposition to it. I'm actually relating to it. I'm actually in connection with it. And from that place, I'm actually starting to, it starts to soften of its own accord. It starts to interrupt and transform that judgment. That's such a, again, embedded part of our mindfulness if we're not paying any attention to it. If we're judging something, we're not able to see it clearly. We're seeing it from, it's really like we're seeing our mirror of our own judgment. Same thing as seeing another person, someone who might take, this is the basis of prejudice. We see someone not through our, who they are, but through our history. And we learn to see the judgment and then we start to release it. So we meet the person how they are. So daily life, this is the meditative practice, but daily life, this really becomes the bedrock of wise investigation, of the feedback, of learning from life. And the key piece is we start to not take things so personally. What I mean by that is we start to have enough sense that this idea of me, of mine, of my ideas, of my identity, isn't as solid as I thought it was. It's not as substantial as I thought it was, either through direct seeing of that or hearing someone talk about the nature of a non-self or simply the way meditation kind of works through the back door. Just by learning how to meet the moment's experience, we're not engaging in our normal mechanism of selfing, of comparing. We become less ego-driven. So when that starts to have a certain momentum, we find ourselves taking things less personal. We can see a pattern arise. I can have someone give us feedback or have that sense of conflict. We're able to meet that without it being like having to be defensive, without having so much of a sense of guarding, something that's fallen away. And that way, paradoxically, we can meet the other person, meet the situation much more fully. Actually start to have appreciation for other people's experiences and perspective. So this is this mental section of we learning how to tame the ox with firmness, but also gentleness. So it starts to become more tame. And the final section is when the ox starts to follow our direction willingly. So the two verses, then unfettered, it obeys its master. The other verse, other translation, and can be unfettered. And then freely, it follows your way. And so somehow the ox from being wild and untamed, being really driven by its the delusion, the sense of wildness, it's become much more gentle, much more accommodating. It can actually follow our direction. Now, from a classical meditative cultivation perspective, this is what's called access concentration. So there's so many different ways we can look at meditation, but one system talks about developing enough steadiness of attention or samadhi that we can actually direct where our attention goes. So it's like learning how to have that enough steadiness, enough undistractedness that we can see more clearly. One direction is going to the jhanas or to the trance states. The other way is to go into investigation. Okay. Our tradition tends to be more toward the investigation or the insight side of things. This is where we can look and see clearly, seeing very clearly without resistance, without judgment. And this is an important thing, that this is a seeing that actually transforms the seer. We actually see in a way that starts to transform us, that we're so open, there's no resistance, that we see things so clearly that we find ourselves being transformed by the very act of seeing. So suddenly there's a complete change of our practice. Instead of us always having to apply our will, our effort, we just have to show up and be present. And that in itself starts to transform us, because we're so open and available to what's being seen. This is when the meditation starts to feel like it's doing itself. It's trying to run itself. This is like a switch from the technique-driven practice, which is so essential for us to find that grounding. How do we actually, what do we do when our mind wanders? What do we focus on with meditation? How do we meet the hindrances? All very important part of our training. It starts to switch to really the attitude, an attitude-driven practice, that we're really attending to this receptivity, this non-judgment, this attitude of deeply learning, and the attitude of not reinforcing that sense of me, the sense of self. This is a movement toward effortlessness, which you see more and more as these pictures unfold. Now, I said that in almost like a very linear standpoint, that once we get past the technique, we don't need to ever do the techniques again. And that's not true. When we help, even people who have practiced for decades and decades, mind situations, life situations, mind states, we sometimes have to go back to the basics. One of my mentors in a different arena, he would say, it's okay to use shortcuts as long as you know the long way home, as long as you know how to go back and really connect with the breath, how to really work with the breath, how to go back to this picture of how do you tame the ox, how do you catch the ox, how do you actually find the ox. You know, sometimes I don't know where the ox was. I used to know where it was. You know, that's okay. That's kind of the cycling of our life. In some ways, those times when we lose the ox are times when we actually have a chance to really deepen into our practice. It doesn't seem like it. We think we've lost it. We've kind of fallen off the wagon or whatever it is. I think of it as more of a wave of our unconsciousness, our division of heart arising. And it's like, that is actually a gift to learn how to see through that again, to find the ox, to sense the ox, to see the ox, to catch the ox, to tame the ox. So not to be discouraged when those times happen, because they happen for everyone, even for the Buddha. So these three elements of learning to first tame the ox, then learning how to have that gentleness, and then finally that when the ox is trying to follow a direction willingly. This is what this image and this month is around. Just a few words around kind of the overall picture of perspective of this. We could say in some ways this is like a level of expertise, perhaps not mastery at this level. Maybe the next picture is really the mastery. But it's not the transcending mastery that these pictures point toward. We're getting good at skillful means of how to find remedies, how to have hacks for our minds and our struggles. You know, we get really good at that. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing to learn how to ground ourselves. We're feeling anxious. It's a good thing to be able to feel emotions in the body instead of being lost in thought. It's good to learn how to work with whatever our mind is coming up with. And yet this picture here is still a picture of duality, of separation. Still an essential part of this, that the mind is divided, the heart is divided. So it's certainly less of a fight. It's not like the last picture, we're really struggling with the ox. That rope is so taut, we're just this little boy struggling with this massive beast. We're starting to become more harmonious in this picture. We're getting along, you know, there's us and the ox. It's clear that separation. Now, if the ox is our true nature, we're relating to it as something outside of ourselves. There's still a part of us that's observing that true nature, trying to relate to it, trying to connect with it. But embedded in that is that quality of separation. And this really points to this, a much deeper root of this division within our own hearts. Division within our own selves. Because there's still this tendency to go into wandering, to reverting back to that fighting. Now, many of us, as I mentioned, can take this picture as this is kind of the culmination of our meditative training. If I can tame that ox, you know, that's all I need to do. I've really gotten there. And that's where the secular mindfulness and the Dharma diverge, is why do we practice? We practice to be able to be calmer, more present, be more productive, have better relationships. These are all good things, absolutely. And yet the Dharma points, that's like a foundational piece. That's why this is picture 5 instead of picture 10. So we get some level of mastery, sense of control over this wildness. We can find that we can reliably connect with the peace, the ease, the clarity. And some of us may be like, I haven't got to that stage, and that's fine. That may not be so reliable. But sometimes we, even once we get to that, it tends to come if we have a commitment to practice, regular practice, we have retreats under our belt, we get better at meditating, just like anything. But sometimes we stop here and say, that's it. And yet really this process continues. The whole journey continues. That's why there's 5 more pictures. And this is really aimed at healing the schism in our hearts. The schism, the division, the separation. This is really the essence of this whole journey. Because the ox in a couple pictures is gone. It's not that it's gone. It's like what's gone is our sense of separation, our sense of division. So I just want to give a preview for that, but also to highlight how this picture this month is in relationship to where the pictures unfold, that we don't stay stuck in this sense of division, of separation, of schism. This picture also is at the end, getting near the end of how far our willpower and our effort can take us, how far our willpower and effort can take us. Because a transformation starts to happen. That really why we're taming the ox is really taming us. You know, particularly around this division, this schism between us and our true nature. And that starts to fall away, so does our effort. And this is what these later pictures point toward. And right now we're really learning how to bring our effort in a skillful way, to gently train our minds, to gently train our hearts, to experience that sense of connection, to learn to find it in all aspects of our lives. So I'll just read the verse one more time, and then we'll sit for a moment or two and then have a chance for some discussion. The 2 verses. The whip and rope are necessary, else it might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, it becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, it obeys its master. Another verse, other translation. The whip and tether cannot be put aside, or the ox may wander into mud-filled swamps. When patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle and can be unfettered. Then freely, it follows your way. All right, just sit quietly for a moment or two, letting those words settle. So I'd like to just share a few words about the homework for this week before we open to any questions and sharing comments. So this homework this week is to bring extra discipline to your daily practice this week. Notice when the mind strays down a dusty road or a mud-filled swamp. Okay, notice how there's a tendency to say, well, that's okay. I can kind of hang out here. And, you know, there's some of it can be very seductive. And some of it can be very painful. But notice, okay, start to notice, okay, I want to keep that ox on the straight and narrow. I want to keep it contained. I want to learn how to train this mind. So that's going to bring you to face with hindrances, going to bring you face with patterns. And bring wise effort to bring your attention back to the present moment and whatever anchor of attention you're using. And reflect on how can this be a gentle process, a wise process. And then practice bringing this same quality to some aspect of your daily life. I mean, certainly if you try to do this 24 hours a day, you're going to be a little exhausted. But just pick something that's kind of a pattern that you want to start to highlight your focus around. And just notice it a bit. Bring that quality of muddy water, you know, going to the mud, going to the dusty road. How can I see that tendency and gently bring myself back? So I'm really speaking from my heart. I'm speaking from my wisdom, acting from my wisdom, acting from my heart. So next week we'll have a recap of this talk. I'll probably elaborate, change it a little bit. And then have a small group discussions. This can really, we can dig in and dive in and explore this, give you a chance to talk in some small groups next week. So let's open to any questions or sharing you might have. So those online, if you could raise your virtual hand. And those in line, you can, in person, I should say, you can raise your physical hand. And I'll try to keep the two straight in my mind. Yes. Do you mind grabbing the mic so we can they can hear you? I'm gonna switch the camera.
Thank you. That's really nice of you. Can you hear me?
Can you hear her online?
Okay.
Say something else then.
Hi, I'm Katrina.
They can hear you. Good.
I was thinking about the ox, and it actually reminded me of this movie I saw long ago called Babies, where the baby was sitting at the foot of the ox while the mother was doing laundry. Mm. And it makes me think about what sort of training that mother had to give that ox so that she could trust her baby just sitting there with the ox. And there was a sense of gentleness with that, you know, with the trust in the baby. And I think there's a lot to be said for that in thinking about things like that and reeling things in. And if you have the appropriate relationship with something, you can even trust your six-month-old to this giant ox.
Yeah, thank you, Katrina. Yes, thank you. That's a beautiful image of the ox, you know, with the young child and that trust the mother had. And that's a great reflection. How can you bring that sense of gentleness? Because, you know, if there was harshness, then it would be, if the whip isn't there, the ox is going to do what it wants. But there's such a transformation of that ox that there's that deep trust, that deep connection, and no fear from that mother. And so how do we bring that to our own mind? If you bring that same quality of treating, how can I treat my tendencies, the wildness in us, if you will, with that same love that the mother showed the ox? So there's going to be that trust of giving something your most precious, that's most precious to you. And that's a powerful image. So thank you for sharing that. I think I saw that movie. It's like showing babies in different cultures and, you know, like Tibet and, you know, Mongolia and things like that. Yeah, I think it's a beautiful, it's a wonderful film. All right. So Carlito online.
Hi, Tim. This is pretty apropos actually. So, you know, at its core, discipline is kind of the task for this week. And so, Yeah, I've been struggling with this for a while, but like that kind of dichotomy between being in the swamp and like, oh crap, I need to get back to my object versus being present with the swamp and just letting it unroll, you know? Do you just have to use your best judgment, basically, and just, okay, this feels like I'm really going off into the weeds, or I'm going to hang with this and it might be kind of ugly and painful for a while and just see what happens, you know? I mean, I guess that's my question.
All right, thank you, Carlito. So if I understand the question correctly, it's like when you're in that swamp, you know, how much do you struggle with it? How much do you get yourself out of the swamp? How much do you just let yourself sink into it and feel the mud covering your body? And which is the right, you know, right effort, right attitude around it? Right. And when do you choose just not to go into the swamp at all, when you start to catch it sooner? And how do you know which is the right way to do it? Yeah, it's an important question. And it really, I always like to point back, whenever I hear that question or when I have that for myself, I point back to looking at what's the effect of both of those choices. How does it actually affect my mind, my heart, the quality of stillness, the quality of agitation, the energy of my body? And so that's kind of the crux. So I'm really pointing to, you know, a deeper discernment around it. So for example, I'm in the muck. Let's say I'm really, you know, triggered by something like, well, let's say, you know, this school shooting, having a teenage daughter. I was talking to her today about it, and she said, well, you know, I've spent my whole school career worrying about this. So it just, this is how it is. And just, you know, that in itself is there's a lot of sadness around it. So I could go down the pathway of just becoming enmeshed in it and lost in it and seeing, you know, hopelessness around it, which it can feel really such a big issue, bigger than anything anything I can do. That leads to, I become ineffectual, I become ungrounded, I lose connection because I'm so overwhelmed by it. Okay, so that's the effects of that pathway are showing me, okay, that's maybe not so helpful. Uh-huh. Okay, then there's the other way, okay, I'm just going to like avoid talking about it. That's her mode, actually. I don't want to talk about it, which, you know, may be very appropriate for her. You're not judging her response to that. But if that can be a denial of it, turning away from that. It's like, okay, I'm not going to go near the muck. I'm going to avoid the muck, do a spiritual bypass. I'm going to build an overwrap so I never have to go in the muck. But one day there's an earthquake and I'm going to fall right in the middle of it. So, you know, that strategy just doesn't work. So my personal preference is when I find myself in the middle of the muck, I say, okay, I'm going to first pause with any impulse to do anything with it other than just to experience it, just notice it. But that's different than going down the pathway, becoming overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's the important caveat there is that capacity to open to it without becoming overwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, each one of us has things that we open to it. It can quickly sweep us away, you know, maybe based on past trauma, past experiences, just our sensitivity around it. So we start to notice when I lose that stability, lose that sense of ground. Okay, then it's better to kind of come out of that muck. But if I'm able to have that sense of balance, and what I like to check for myself is, can I be aware of this muck, this mud, this pain, and equally at the same time be aware of something else or other things in the moment? So like right now, if I'm talking to you, I can be aware of the people here in the room. I can be aware of the play of the light, the gentle evening light on the trees. I can be aware of the people here in the Zoom, and I can also be aware of that pain. So if I'm aware of all of those, see, there's a breadth, a broadness of my awareness. Well, when I lose awareness, when I lose that breadth, it's like I become the tunnel vision. Yeah, there's like no separations, no space, and I become overwhelmed. I can become re-traumatized by that. So a lot of it is just, yeah, really noticing, you know, test it out in little ways. Notice, okay, is my capacity to open to this up to the task? If not, it's wiser to come out of the muck and find that balance. You know, as long as you're not, you know, bypassing. And what I know of you, you don't bypass stuff. It's more of that you know, falling into the muck more than you want to. You know, so it's like you have to know your tendency. If you're like, oh, I can just go into samadhi, I can just kind of jump over this, you know, then it's better to actually, let's get your toes dirty kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Does that help, Carlito?
Yeah, and I think the concept of pendulation came to mind as well, sort of dipping in for a little bit and then dipping back out. And okay, yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly. That sense of going in a little bit, going out a little bit. So you kind of learn that balance.
Right.
Because, you know, if you stay in too long, you lose your fetting. So you say leave sooner and then go back and forth. And that really just builds a capacity nicely. Hmm. You work that edge in a way that's doable, that's growing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Sometimes, you know, the lack of questions, sometimes things are just clear. There's a sense of settledness. Sometimes there's, you know, just a little nervousness about talking in a group. I certainly can relate to that. And sometimes there's an element of not being so fully engaged in your practice. You know, sometimes, you know, just reflect, you know, how burning is my practice? How, like, I'll think back last month when this little guy is trying to hold this big ox. Someone was saying that, you know, just it seemed like the wise thing to do is just let go of the ox because it's so big, you know. But that little boy has this really deep passion for understanding the ox. So, you know, he's really willing to hold on to it. To hold on to it and grapple with it. And sometimes we, you know, we need to refresh that, to find that life, that really that burning passion. So just throwing that out there as a reflection, you know, where am I? Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, as someone who works like in child welfare, I have a hard time with the whip and the rope.
Yes.
I don't like the concept of this violent image. I know it's metaphorical, but I still have a hard time relating to that portion of it. And I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Sure. All right. So the comment is just the, you know, the really disturbing image of the whip and the rope and the tether. And it is, you know, there is a violence to that. There is an over-controlling and certainly, you know, working in child welfare, you know, there's lots of abuse that you see in a very painful, you know, you see the actual, you know, on the ground. I mean, my mother was a pediatrician and she worked with, you know, had to testify against a lot of parents because of the child abuse. And just, I saw some of the slides and it's horrific, you know, that parents would do that, you know? And so, and it is, you know, partly is the culture that this came from, you know, I don't know when this was built. I should know when it was first done, but it's, you know, many hundreds of years ago and more of the Chinese or Japanese culture. I forget which one, probably, you know, but the Zen, you know, there's a cultural piece there. And so what I would say is just kind of set that aside and say, you know, maybe, you know, have, instead of saying the whip and the rope, say just the sense of guidance, the sense of container. So just, you know, feel for any time a teaching is not supportive or, you know, is triggering, you know, feel free to, I'm very pragmatic. I don't hold what's said here as the gospel truth, you know, just throw that part out. Instead, just say, okay, how can I have that sense of that firmness, that structure. Because, you know, as you know, children need both love, but also need structure. They need healthy structure so they can feel safe. They can start to thrive. And that's the structure that I think is much more helpful, especially with our, you know, with our cultural baggage of that internal hatred, critic, self-inadequacy, unlovability, and then certainly working in that kind of painful field. Is you really change it to that healthy structure, the structure that allows that child to thrive. Think of it that way. That's how I would interpret it. Because, you know, to be honest, it's hard for me to read that those two. You know, it's just not the way we, even if you're trying to train a dog right now, you don't use those tools. You use kindness, you use clarity. You know, that seems to work much better. So it does need to be updated, I guess. So does that help? Yeah, that's an important thing to voice. And yeah, make the teachings work for you. Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, I saw Beth first. Let's go with Beth and we'll come back online if there's anything.
I don't know how far this goes. Everybody still wants to.
When I read the homework, I wouldn't say I felt a whip, but I definitely felt like it was speaking to me in the mud. I just noticed recently I want to say the word laziness, and I don't think it's lazy because I feel like I am practicing mindfulness during the day, but I've noticed that I've stopped mental noting, you know, that I haven't been, you know, where did pleasant and unpleasant go? I just realized that I haven't been doing that. I feel like I'm being mindful, but I feel like I've caught up short. I feel like there's a fine tuning that is missing that, from that, that practice. So.
All right. Thank you, Beth. Yeah, that's an important, counterpoint is, you know, that sense we do need that firmness. We do need that training. And, you know, how do we do it in a way that, you know, and we have to kind of like the Carlito's question is we also notice the cause and effect of how we treat ourselves. So like we have the idea of a whip and a tether and we find that reaction or we have that self-harshness. We start to learn, okay, we have the discernment to know that's not the right direction. That's not skillful. And at the same time, we say, okay, just whatever is good, you know, that's also not skillful because then the ox will kind of wander wherever it wants. And so we start to learn where is that firmness. And that's, got to remember, yeah, that, I mean, my early days, I really had a lot of effort to try to work with that sleepiness and the dullness and bringing a lot of energy. And eventually something transformed. I needed to use a lot less effort. And yet sometimes when my mind is agitated, when I'm struggling with something, then I have to bring in that firmness. But I think it's much better to have that gentleness. And in fact, maybe the next talk I do in 2 weeks, I'll translate this a little bit, you know, addressing what you, I think those are good points. How do we have that firmness without the harshness? And how do we bring those together? Because we do have to have a certain commitment to practice. You know, the Buddha would often really encourage people to have a sense of urgency. Sometimes you would say, you know, just as a person whose hair is on fire, how much urgency would they have to putting that fire out? It's like we feel that dukkha. And sometimes we feel that when we have brushes against our mortality. We feel, okay, life is not as long as I think it's going to be. That's where the urgency comes up. Sometimes it's coming from, you know, as death as an advisor. Sometimes it's coming more from just that passion to see and to understand. And we have to temper that with how much striving we have, how much contraction we have, how much, you know, because that's also spiritual practitioners. There's so many that hurt themselves through that striving, through that over efforting. Yeah.
Well, as you're speaking, I was thinking that, you know, this practice in the more recent years of practice have been the first time in my life, I'm nearly 60 years old, where discipline did not mean the whip mentally. Just from my lifetime of formation, you know, I never did the whip on anybody else, I promise. But, you know, mentally, I think that's how I managed. And the idea of gentleness toward myself and toward my mind is actually, you know, quite a relatively new thing. So thank you.
Yeah, so hopefully you heard that follow-up that the, you know, just the historically, and I think many people can relate to that, is that, you know, we do have that internal whip, that internal harshness, and we start to actually drop that away. That's really a revelation. It's like, oh, wow, I can actually relate to myself, not through that harshness. And there's, of course, psychological reasons for that. There's family origin. There's cultural, you know, there's societal ways. But what's important is, from a dharmic standpoint, that perspective of the whip is a great way to keep that sense of self intact. It's like, you, because you really know who you are when you're punishing yourself, when you're forced to, you're like, okay, I know you're really formed. There's no question of where the world is and where you are. It's all codified. It's like solid. You do something like you start to release that sense of self-judgment and that internal whip, you become less defined. That's the trajectory of practice. It certainly helps you live a much more gentle life, much more kind life, much more enjoyable life. It translates to all your relationships. And from a dharmic standpoint, it also has the benefit, it starts to loosen that belief in self. That self is so based for many of us on that foundation of self-hatred. All right, Kathy.
Tim, I just wanted to say here, I'm finding this very helpful. And I so much appreciate you bringing in two versions of the poem as well. There are a lot of nuances here that are implied in these two versions. And then, of course, thinking of it in more contemporary terms. But just really helpful for me in being gentle toward myself. I'm looking forward to trying that out. So thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. Yeah, that sense of gentleness, it's been a tremendous part of my own practice, my own path. And I just wanted, there was a chat. Where did that go? There. There's anonymous, which is fine. Just, you know, thanking about the triggering, the person who shared about the being triggered by violent images, and the noticing that becoming more gentle and tender with themselves, meeting whatever arises, the softness and offering yourself something nurturing while I'm in that suffering. You know, and so it's really the firmness is that the retraining yourself to guide yourself gently through it and choosing what is kindness to me instead of your own habit of punishing. Yeah, the dukkha in the first place, which I have no control over. Yeah, that's beautifully said. Yeah, so it's exactly, it's like that's where we really learn that. And this is actually helping me the next talk. I think I'll really reframe this phrase and bring that in. It's such an important way to update this. Okay, Matt, let's go ahead. We'll have you be the last question, and then we'll have some comments or announcements. That's the word.
Thanks. I have a follow-up, I think, to your answer to Carlito about when you find yourself contracting around something difficult, the technique of, you know, trying to bring some spaciousness and some focus, you know, on different things going on or in your awareness. And I've been experimenting with that for a bit and think that's useful. But something I've noticed sometimes that thing I'm contracting around has so much like gravitational pull that it can be very difficult to like expand my awareness at all, because it like, you know, that thing is, I don't know, so the thing I'm contracting around is so interesting to my mind or so, you know, like forceful that it's hard to like, you know, my mind isn't as interested in the sound of the birds or whatever else is going on. It just keeps contracting back. So I'm wondering if you have any advice when that's going on.
Sure. So something that has really a strong gravitational pull that your mind just gloms into it. Is it more of something that's painful or something more that's kind of interesting and fascinating?
I think more often, yeah, something painful. Could be physical or mental, I guess.
All right. Yeah, that's probably the more common one. Because if it's interesting, it's like we don't feel that the problem. There is a little problem in that, but it's harder to really see it. So, but yeah, it's often that painful part. So we look at something and it's because it ties into something we take so personally, so deep, you know, maybe connects with our childhood. You know, it's so charged. I came up with this analogy once doing an interview on a retreat. It's almost like if I had this, let's say, a book that held, you know, all this pain. Instead of opening it and just forcing myself to read it, maybe close the book, put it off to the side of your vision so you know the book's there. And so this is where the firmness or that sense of direction of your attention is. You're not denying the fact the book is there, but you're also acknowledging that you just get sucked into it. You lose all perspective. So you're kind of aware of the book. You can maybe feel the heat coming off it, but you're really intentionally balancing your attention in other things in the moment. You know, things especially which are either neutral perception or even pleasant assumption. This is actually part of somatic experiencing and how to work with trauma is learning to really balance that attention. So you may not see the book, but I don't rush into opening to it. I just kind of notice the heat of it. And at the same time, I'm really balancing my attention. Then you start to find that heat kind of dissipates a little bit. So maybe you'll look at the cover of the book a little bit. It's like, okay, that's starting to get loose. I go back. So it's really that pendulation or that titration that you go back and forth. And so by doing that, it's actually a profound way to develop the capacity to hold what's difficult. But if we turn right into it, it exceeds our capacity and it's counterproductive. You know, we become overwhelmed by it. And sometimes life, there's situations are like that. We have to either, you know, grow through it. We have to find some way to hold on. But if we have the choice, it's better to practice in this gentle way. And that way we start to find that eventually we can open the book for a little while and then close it. And eventually it doesn't matter if the book's open or not, because we've allowed it to discharge and we've had that balance. Because eventually, you know, you'd start to be able to turn directly toward it and see, you know, the unhooking of that self-identity with it. But often that hook is so deep, you have to work with it gently. All right. Thank you for sharing that, Matt.
Thank you.
So thank you all for your, as Iris said, for your questions. It really helps to flesh out practice for all of us. Everyone's voice is really appreciated and it helps kind of show a different aspect of it. And I thank you again for your sincere participation. So have a wonderful evening and we'll see you the next time.